The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
And so we're going to go probably 60 minutes with the panel or so, and then we'll have time for questions from the audience. So I'm going to turn it over.
Can I have the mic?
Yes.
No, thank God. So we're going to do this sitting down. Hopefully in the back you all can hear. We want to be able to pass back and forth a little. I don't know if this thing could maybe move a little bit. Oh, don't break it. But first I just want to start by thanking all of the comrades here on the panel for coming here from Puerto Rico. We all know that the past almost 10 months have been a collective trauma that we have, really just been watching and trying to understand from afar, and the struggles that you all have been involved with have been a source of inspiration for us, and you help us to both understand better what is happening, but also have the understanding that a different world is possible. What we're going to do is, we came up with some questions to help people better understand both what's happened in Puerto Rico over the past 10 months, but even before. And we'll have a conversation among us, and then we'll have time for a conversation all together. There are comrades, in addition to those on the stage, in the audience who came from the islands, and if you could just maybe stand up so that we can see you. So hopefully you all can join in this discussion. Okay, so we're gonna jump in. If I forgot anything, please let me know. So on September 20th of last year, as folks I'm sure know, Hurricane Maria, a Category 4 or 5 hurricane, with winds up to 250 miles per hour, hit Puerto Rico. And for many people in the U.S., witnessing the abandonment of the people of Puerto Rico after the hurricane was actually their first time of learning about the colonial status of Puerto Rico. Now, shortly after the hurricane, the devastation of the storm was all over the headlines, and the nightly news, and many people, it was all over the headlines and nightly news, and many people wanted to help, even while Trump insulted the people. Now we know that upwards of 5,000 people died as a result, and people continue to die as a result of the healthcare crisis. So I'm gonna ask you all to sort of use that as a jumping off point and talk to us a bit about the ways in which the storm was so much more than just a natural disaster. Who would like to start?
Hello. Okay, so I think that it's impossible to say that the damage that Maria did to Puerto Rico wasn't vast and gross from a natural disaster perspective. Mm-hmm. However, I think it's crucial to understand that when we talk about disaster in Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico has had an economical and political disaster for quite a while. You know, most recently with the passing of PROMESA, if you heard Merced talk yesterday, you know a little bit about, you know, the Fiscal Control Board in 2008. But even before that, with the invasion of the United States in 1898, and even before that, right, with the original colonization of Puerto Rico. So, and I think that the hurricane just made that much more visible. When we talk about how the government abandoned Puerto Rico, I think it's important that it's not that the government, you can't say the government is incapable of doing of supporting. You can't say that it's incompetent. I mean, I think that's what happens in the end, but it's not that. It's disinterest, or rather a different interest, an interest in capitalist interests, right? And the government of Puerto Rico is nothing more than a middle administrator for the federal government of the United States, and that's what was clear after the hurricane. What we saw, like on the ground, trying to do relief work, was the way that the local government had to just kind of sit back and wait for FEMA to arrive, right? For the federal agency for a federal emergency management agency to arrive. And what we had is politicians sitting at the convention center where the government moved, just like hanging out, mm-hmm. waiting for that to happen. And then what came to Puerto Rico was like a military invasion. And who were here supposed to administrate all the help, but that's not what we saw. They were focused on protecting gas stations and economic interests, and people didn't see military support at all. And what PROTECT ended up looking at was just a show of control. You know, we'd be driving down the street and you'd see like trucks with military men just like sitting, driving through the highway, and you're like, where are you going? Because I've been to all these communities and I haven't seen any of these people there. And you know, that came with like, you know, crop support, like the food that they were giving out was not nutritious and it was disrespectful, the treatment. And what we also saw, and it was really crazy to see, is how supplies were held at the ports. For us, you know, expecting relief, we had this like $1,000 relief package that was coming. It was all of these things. And when it came, it was like not even half of the products. Yeah. People would arrive at the ports looking for the relief they were expecting from the diaspora and from other support, and they'd be told that it's not there or that they can't get it yet. And food was rotting in these ports. People would go with like trucks and offer to move the food, and they'd just be like, no, because it has to be the military convoys that do it. And it was just really, really terrible. And it also just made really visible multiple levels of privilege and oppression in Puerto Rico. I mean, first and foremost, class. I remember the first couple of days, hospitals, and even for longer, for weeks, hospitals didn't have access to the diesel that they needed to run the power plants in their hospitals. But a couple of days after Maria, the richest neighborhoods in Puerto Rico were already receiving diesel delivered to their households. Mm. And that happened in a variety of different resources. We saw the way that women were victimized and still are being more victimized on the streets. Right now, we have an alarming rate of women being murdered by their partners in Puerto Rico, higher than it already was before. And also with race, you know? The areas of Puerto Rico with black people were the ones that were most ignored and have always been the ones that are most ignored. And I think it's important, obviously, to say that Puerto Ricans didn't just sit back and let this happen. And I'm really looking forward to talking about that a little bit later. Yeah, I think that's that for me, for now. Yeah? Okay.
Yo
tengo lo mismo.
Okay, so I'm gonna try not to repeat what Stephanie said. So just to give you some statistics, 70,000 of the homes of Puerto Rican people after the hurricane were completely destroyed. More than 300,000 homes have damages, a lot of damages in them. 10 months past the hurricane, we still have 70,000 people with blue tarps on their roofs. The government of Puerto Rico took advantage of disaster capitalism and privatized the Puerto Rico Electrical Power Authority right now. So they're privatizing energy and not talking about renewable green energy for our country. We are an island, but being a colony, we have 15% of the food that we consume, we produce in the island. 85% of the food is imported. So once the hurricane hit us, you know how hungry the people of Puerto Rico were. And that was very bad. We had a Secretary of Education that has 1,100 schools that have gas stoves and that have food that could be cooked for the children of Puerto Rico, and they denied to open any of the 1,100 schools. So children were hungry. People in very poor communities received no help. And the hurricane was a natural disaster, but it unveiled the real disaster that we have in our country, which is colonialism, imperialism, being a colony from the US for more than 120 years. A colony from Spain for more than 400 years. So it is unveiled what was hiding. You know, you have this nature and you have the bushes and you have the trees hiding it all. But once the hurricane hit, it was naked on the face, you know, a colony. We have a president of the United States that went to throw paper towels at the people of Puerto Rico. And everybody caught that on camera. While we had people that were dying every day people, 484,000 people left the island in a period of 3 months. A lot of them because of medical reasons. We had no electricity, so a lot of people needed machinery to stay alive, oxygen. Since the country didn't have any electricity, they were forced to move out of the country. Mm-hmm. Now they're trying to force people to move out of the country. I'll talk about this later with the school closures. If you eliminate a school from this community, from the rural area, from the mountains, people have no transportation, have no way of getting there. You're forcing them to leave our country, to leave the island. And at the same time, Unveiled, the true problem of colonialism, it already unveiled what solidarity is like in our country as well. And there's a saying like, only the people will save the people. So that's what the people of Puerto Rico did with a lot of international solidarity of workers and people just like you from all over the world. It was very, very emotional for all of us seeing such an amount of huge solidarity display brigades that came to the island to assist us. At the same time, it was very sad to see how international aid was denied to enter our country because of our colonial status. Cuba offered medical services, they were denied to enter the country. Venezuela offered to help, they were denied to enter our country. There was a ship, I forgot the name of the ship, that was denied to enter, and they had to have the US flag. They couldn't have their flag to ship in our island to provide aid and assistance to a lot of people that were sick. So it was very disgusting to see the colony naked itself and how they mistreated the people of Puerto Rico with this natural disaster. And we see the other side of solidarity, of a lot of love, not charity, solidarity from people all around the world that have helped us. As of we speak, we have 7,000 people in Puerto Rico still without electricity, 7,000 families. So maybe 4 per family, 28,000 people still have no electricity. So imagine how hard things are from the island. We are supposed to go back to our country some tomorrow, and a tropical storm was announced. It just degraded, so there's no worry. But imagine the people re-traumatized, going to the gas stations because they were gonna have no gas, going to supermarkets, worrying that they will have nothing to eat in the country. So it was vivid, people that have no roofs. Imagine a storm right now where people have nowhere to go, have nowhere to live. School communities were shut down, art was shut down, so refugee centers, which are the schools, are not open. Where are the people gonna go? So it's very hard, and that's what the hurricane has unveiled for us.
Joshua. Okay. Well, thank you for getting us started with those thoughts, because we're all sort of continuing to process what has happened. And I would just say that, you know, many of us at this conference are involved in and closely follow the movement to save public education, both at a school level and at a university level. If you were around last night, it was electrifying. And there's a struggle. There's a struggle in Puerto Rico about the future of education. And it would be, and I know that all of you have been involved in that struggle at different times and at different, in different, you know, parts of education. Can you tell us a bit about the government's efforts to take advantage of the crisis in order to carry out the plans to privatize education?
Okay, so I'm a student at the University of Puerto Rico as well. I actually came into the student movement right at the beginning of the last student strike. But the thing is, you know, in the same way as with public education and with everything else, the attacks on education aren't new. They're not post Maria, right? The attacks on education have been pretty much the same and have had the same story and the same numbers even for years and years and years now. And at the University of Puerto Rico, there is a long, long history of resistance. And it's been that resistance which has helped to keep those efforts at hiking tuition and privatizing sectors of the university and consolidating campuses. And that's what we saw in 2017 when the same plan that we're facing now was proposed. And in response to these cuts that were being threatened, and in response in general to what was happening on the island, because our analysis and the clear reality is that the cuts being made to education aren't coming from the university administration. They're not even coming from local government at this point. They're coming from, you know, the fiscal control board, and they're coming from the United States, and they're coming from broader capitalist interests. So our demands were broader in that sense. And so we took the school for 74 days. And that meant the physical occupation of the campus, as well as protests. And you know, this space was very important in terms of political education and organization, and it did succeed at stopping that plan, which would have been approved a year ago for that time. And it also, I think, was very instrumental in public knowledge about the debt in Puerto Rico. You know, students were on the street giving names and last names to the people who are guilty, right? People like Jose Carrion and Carlos Garcia, who are bankers, who were heavily participants in creating the debt that we have and now sit on the fiscal control board. So that's something that was really important to us, and also in making visible the possibility of auditing the debt. So then the strike ends, and you know, the semester continues, but then the hurricane hits. Right, and so post Maria, things are really difficult. Obviously, there's an organizational burnout from students from a 74-day long strike, and the psychological warfare that played a role in the process of us being, you know, almost left to cook inside that university as the government just bet towards the just ignoring the students. So after that. After the hurricane, though, many students moved towards relief work and community work around Maria Relief, and were instrumental in a lot of spaces in Rio Piedras and in other parts of the island. You know, but what happened after the hurricane was that we were already, you know, living these constraints of how our semester was getting harder and tighter and more complicated. And what happened after Maria is that students were forced to go into a 3-month long semester, disguised as a trimester, but with the same expectations of a semester. And that, coupled with each student's individual struggles post hurricane, really put students in terrible conditions. I don't think ever in my life I've seen so many students crying in bathrooms during finals. Depression was so intense, and you could just feel it in the space. And that obviously made it very difficult to stand up and to fight back. And it was really hard, because it's just another example of how they took advantage of the disaster and they just passed that same plan. So now we're facing, in August, a doubling of our tuition from like $55 a credit to $115, and it's going to be even more every semester for the next 2 years. They're consolidating campuses. They closed one of the only left housing options for students in Rio Piedras that are from farther or from lower resources. And it's tough, right? And to us in the student movement, it's been clear that the University of Puerto Rico hasn't been accessible for a long time, right? It's not accessible as universities aren't, you know? It's not accessible for the majority of Puerto Ricans, because the majority of Puerto Ricans are told that they can't go to college, and it's expensive, and it's almost impossible, right? So now to think about what that's gonna look like in August is frankly really, really terrifying and really painful. But you know, that's what we're facing. So it's gonna be really, really important next year for students to kind of figure out how we fight back. Because this university has been successful, and this student movement has been successful in fighting back many, many times before, and it will again. So, yeah.
Okay, so I would add to what Stephanie said, that repression has gotten worse in our country as well. Mm-hmm. We have here students of the University of Puerto Rico, some of them are afraid to see right now court cases. When they were trying to fight back against the tuition hike, they took over a meeting or the president of the UPR was at, and they have been charged with a lot of inhuman, unfair, unimaginable charges. So they need all the solidarity we can get. These are students that are fighting for the right of higher education for all of the Jews of Puerto Rico. They can stand, so you can see them, the students from the University of Puerto Rico that are here with us. So. Amazing, but it's hard to fight when you are being repressed. The penal code was amended in the country. So, for example, if you obstruct the entrance to a school, you may get 3 years in prison. If you obstruct, if you interrupt a meeting of the board, you may get 8 years. They accuse you of kidnapping, of hijacking, of escalating, of obstruction of justice. And when you have all these charges, you may face up to 20 years in prison. So they are trying to apply a terror doctrine, a shock doctrine on the people of Puerto Rico, so they will be silent and they will not fight back. So imagine children fighting for what's right, our youth fighting for what's right, and facing all this. So the people of Puerto Rico have a huge debt with the student movement, and all the country needs to get involved. We need to understand that there is no individual solution to a collective problem. So we all need to be in all the struggles together, because they are all intertwined. As far as the education department, as we spoke yesterday, after the hurricane hit, we've been facing privatization and fighting against this for more than 25 years. In Puerto Rico, up till this day, there's no charter schools, even though they have been trying to implement them for years. And it's because of the resistance that the teachers, the students, the parents, and the entire communities have given to the government. Yesterday, the court decided that it was unconstitutional, so they will not be able to start in August as they planned to. But after this hurricane hit us, the Secretary of Education, Yulia Kelleher, who's making $250,000, tried and said literally that she was going to convert Puerto Rico into the New Orleans of the 21st century. Disaster capitalism on steroids. You're going to shut down hundreds of schools. You're going to privatize the schools that you shut down. You're going to provide these buildings to the rich so they can do their businesses in them. You're going to demolish the buildings that are no use to you so you can build whatever luxury properties you want to benefit. They see this as an opportunity. Puerto Rico is a fiscal paradise for all these people. They only pay 4% of taxes, and they make more than $35 billion in profit per year. So this is the great opportunity for them to take advantage. If you want to be rich in Puerto Rico, then go to the education department. And that's what they've been doing. But after this hurricane hit us, it was very sad to see children crying. Children that lost everything. Children that had nothing to wear. It's very emotional, you know, children with nothing to eat. And they have no houses, that the families are forced to move here. And you have this government, this inhuman government, that's attacking them, and leaving the children with nothing. So it was our duty to fight back. And even though we were hurt, and even though we were hit very hard by this hurricane, and by this woman, and by the control board, which is a dictatorship, 7 members, not elected officials, appointed during Barack Obama's presidency by US Congress in our country. And even though we're facing this, communities rose up, and we have mothers and grandmothers every day protesting after the hurricane in front of their schools, requesting the government to open them in order to fight back and to guarantee some type of normalcy for the children. They needed to be children, they needed to play, they needed to feel happy. Suicide rates have gone up to 50% in Puerto Rico right now after the hurricane hit us. So we needed to do this for the children and for the working class. Teachers in Puerto Rico, their heroes and heroes, machete in hand, chainsaw in hand, they fixed the schools, they cut the trees, they opened the roads, they took care of their children, they gathered donations, they fed them, they provided them clothes, shelter. We went in the Federación, as the students did, we did brigades, and we started going to put the roofs on the schools that lost them, the houses of the students that lost them, on the houses of the teachers, We were feeding each other. Comedores Sociales is going to talk a little bit more about that. They did a magnificent work, auto-sustainable work of feeding the people of Puerto Rico. So this woman was not able to shut down the schools. She had to revoke the schools that she announced after the hurricane because she did not expect such a big resistance. But now in January, I forgot, I was telling Monique, I was laughing because I was giving the talk yesterday and I forgot to talk about the strike. It was teachers rebelling and I talked about a lot of things, but I forgot to say teachers fought back when we faced privatization march. We have another union, a pro-business union in Puerto Rico, who has never supported the fights of the people, of the teachers and the students. But even though we have this union, well, it's not a union, whatever you can call them, teachers in Puerto Rico spoke, and they shut down the Department of Education on March 19, and they shut down the Department of Education May 1st this year. Repression was horrible, but teachers were there. We went to the Department of Education. We were attacked by the police. We received pepper spray, tear gas. We were hit and abused, but that did not stop us from fighting back for what's right for our students. And right now, we are giving the biggest fight of our life in defense of public education, proper funding, no cuts to special education students, and they are trying to shut down 300 schools first. They lowered the number to 283, then to 266. Then we won a case in court with 9 schools, so it's 256. And at the end of the month, we have, right now, they have called me for more schools, so it's gonna be approximately 60 more schools in the court case. In the court, we don't know what to expect them from. We don't know what to expect from them, but they have been acting on behalf of the people of Puerto Rico with the school cases this last week, so we're hoping that the 60 schools remain open. We have the Luis Muñoz Rivera School right now in Dorado, which is occupying the school for 12 days. We have the Lorencita Ramirez Arellano School, which has been occupied by the parents for the past 12 days as well. So when we finish, if you want to take a picture to support these schools, at least mothers are there, sleeping there, avoiding the trucks to come and remove the materials for the children, we can send them a message of solidarity. We don't know how many schools we're going to be able to save, but we know that we are doing what we have to do, and we continue to do what we have to do in order to be able to look at the face and at the eyes of our students and know that we did what we had to for them. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.